You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Earlier this summer, I produced a show on the Roswell UFO Festival, in which tens of thousands of people get together to talk about spaceships, aliens, government conspiracies, and all kinds of related things, many of which stretch credibility, I think, for most ordinary people. Well, today we're going to talk to an astrophysicist who asks many of the same questions, but is totally grounded in science as we know it. All that in a moment. On September 23rd and 24th, at the Lenzic, the Santa Fe Institute's 2019 ULAM Lecture Series goes to the forefront of infectious disease research. Join epidemiologist Lauren Ansel Myers to learn how scientists use social media and internet search data to save lives, and how the science of networks may help prevent the next pandemic. These two lectures are self-contained and can be enjoyed together or separately. Free tickets are available at ticketsantafe.org. Support for this program comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a talk by Vijay Prashad in conversation with Melanie K. Yazzie on Wednesday, September 25th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic in Santa Fe. Vijay Prashad is a Marxist historian and journalist and the author of 25 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. He also is the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, a global movement-driven research institution. Tickets available at the Lenzic or lenzic.org. I'd like now to welcome Paul Davies. He's a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and astrobiologist. He's Regents Professor and Director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science and co-director of the Cosmology Initiative at Arizona State University. So you wrote a wonderful book called The Eerie Silence on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of SETI. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. How did you get interested in the idea that there might be life beyond Earth, and how have you sustained that interest over these many years of not necessarily finding life from other planets?
It's a very curious thing. I was fascinated as a teenager with the idea of life beyond Earth, probably due to exposure to science fiction. And in those days, and we're talking back in the 60s, nobody, almost no scientist, was prepared to entertain the idea of extraterrestrial life. One might as well have professed an interest in looking for fairies. It was considered so bizarre. And because I've always gone against the trend, I sustained the interest by thinking, oh, well, you know, there's a conspiracy of silence or something. What is the matter with these scientists? There's this huge universe out there, and surely there's going to be life somewhere. And on and off, I followed the subject, but I became more seriously interested professionally in the 1980s. And a turning point for me was a conference that Martin Rees, now Britain's Astronomer Royal, held in Cambridge, UK in 1983. And it drew a number of figures who've since been very influential in the origin of life field, including Freeman Dyson, for example, and Sidney Brenner was there. He was the person who took over from Francis Crick, and a number of astronomers. And for me, it got me thinking very much about the nature of life. And I'd already read Schrödinger's book, What is Life? And so I began to think very profoundly about the nature of life. And this interest continued. And the strange thing that happened, in the 1990s, the pendulum swung, and suddenly even very distinguished scientists were saying, oh, well, the universe must be teeming with life. And NASA created its Astrobiology Institute in the mid-90s, and suddenly everybody was jumping on the life is everywhere bandwagon. And for me, being a contrarian sort of fellow, that meant I swung the other way. I began to get skeptical. I remembered the things people said to me in the 60s and 70s, and I said them back. What justification do you have for believing in life beyond Earth? And so I've become very skeptical, but I'm one of these people who would call themselves an interested skeptic. I think it's a fascinating topic. It's a really important topic. But I have to say I'm much more skeptical now about finding ET than I was when I was a teenager.
When I say the word alien to people, they immediately go to little gray spacemen with big heads or whatever. But from the perspective of science, the question of extraterrestrial life raises this really interesting question that you're talking about. What do we mean by intelligence? What do we mean by life? And that leads to the problem of anthropomorphism, like applying our definitions of life and intelligence to the rest of the universe. How do you think about this? How do you sort that out?
In my book, The Eerie Silence, I really tried to confront that issue head on, because you're absolutely right. There is a huge amount of cultural baggage that goes into this search for ET. I guess because we don't have examples of life beyond Earth, all we've got to go on is our own life and our own intelligence and our own society. And we can extrapolate that. We can think, well, if you had a technological society that had been around 1 million years, what might it achieve, or 10 million years? But this is a little bit pathetic, just taking our current trends and projecting into the future. We need to think right outside the box. We need to confront the fact that intelligence, if it does exist beyond Earth, might manifest itself in a very different way. And to be honest, we're not actually looking for intelligence as such. We're looking for technology. We're looking for non-human technology beyond Earth, or for that matter, on Earth, but the search is almost all beyond Earth. And how might technological society that have been around for, say, 10 million years or 50 million years, what sort of technology might it have? How might that manifest itself? And it's really very, very hard to know. And in fact, even coming up with a definition of what would constitute artificial as opposed to natural is fraught with difficulties. There seems to be no objective way that we could look at an object or a system or a process and say we see the hand of agency in it. We can recognize this in daily life with human agency, but alien agency, is there any objective way of detecting that? I think these are still very, very deep problems. They're problems that I'm interested in and working on. I don't think we've solved it yet. So the search for ET is really a search by analogy with terrestrial technology. And that can get you so far. And of course, unfortunately, we haven't yet found anything beyond Earth that is non-human technology. I should say right away that we've certainly detected technology beyond Earth. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is mapping the moon to half-meter resolution, and it sees plenty of technology, but it all came from the United States or the Soviet Union, and now one or two other nations. That's human technology. We have the capability in near space of spotting non-human technology, but we just haven't seen any.
One of the things that I think was so interesting about your book that affects our understanding of how life might arise on other planets is the fact that we don't really understand how life arose on our own planet. I mean, we know that several billion years ago, we had the conditions for biological life, water, organic compounds, temperature conditions, and so on. But we still don't know how all of that, I mean, how that moment of going from matter into life happened. Where is science with that question?
You're absolutely right to identify the origin of life, which is the transition from non-life to life, a mishmash of chemicals into some primitive living thing, as the big unknown. There's something called the Drake equation. Frank Drake, who founded the field of SETI back in 1960, wrote down a collection of terms which we don't fully know or understand, but which are essential for estimating the amount of intelligent life that might be out there. And one of those terms is the fraction of Earth-like planets on which life emerges at some stage. And he thought, oh, well, maybe that would be like 10% or something. But we have absolutely no idea. Given another planet just like Earth, 4.5 billion years ago, somewhere out there in the galaxy, what are the chances that today it would have life on it? Well, we absolutely have no idea how to even estimate the odds. And it's just not even guesswork, it's just wishful thinking to say that just because there are billions of Earth-like planets in our galaxy, there will be billions of planets with life on it. We just don't know what that number is, because we don't know the process that turned non-life into life. So I keep emphasizing this point to my astrobiology colleagues, and somehow they don't seem to get it. The point here is that you can't estimate the odds of an unknown process. If you tell me how non-life turned into life, if you give me the 25 chemical steps or whatever it would be and the conditions for them to happen, I could have a go at estimating how often that had occurred in the observable universe. But if you say, well, I don't know what that process was, so give me a number, well, I can't give you a number. It's a completely meaningless exercise.
Right.
So all of these sorts of odds that scientists, sometimes very distinguished scientists, trot out in the media, completely bogus, absolutely without any foundation whatsoever. Total, not guesswork, but dream work. So my feeling is that we won't make any progress on this unless one of two things happen. One is that we actually find a second sample of life, and we may not have to look very far. It could be that there's a second sample of life right here on Earth.
Right.
If we found life had started on Earth more than once, then clearly it can't be that hard to get going. So that's one way. The other way is that through theory and maybe some laboratory experiments, we will come to have a pretty good understanding of the sequence of processes that occurred or the laws that might govern the transition from non-life to life. We're a long way from that at the moment, but if we understood that well enough, we could perhaps have a stab at estimating how often it would happen. But we're really completely in the dark. Unlike, I should emphasize, the transition from life to intelligence, a lot of astrobiologists will say, oh, well, probably there's a lot of life out there, but intelligent life will be very rare. Well, that statement may be true, but the point being that we know how microbes have transformed themselves into intelligent beings here on planet Earth. We know what that process is. It's called Darwinian evolution. We still can't do the arithmetic to work out how likely that is, but at least we know the process. But in going from non-life to life, we don't even know what the process is, and the numbers are completely meaningless.
What do you mean by intelligence? I mean, if we think of humans as intelligent, then we're defining it ourselves. Sometimes we say our dogs are intelligent, or dolphins. Some people say that grass is intelligent because it survived so well. What do you mean? I mean, are you defining it by ability to leave the planet and go elsewhere in the universe?
Your question is very perceptive, because there are actually many different forms of intelligence, even among human beings. For example, we might distinguish between mathematical ability and social intelligence, and both are important. When it comes to non-human intelligence, really in the SETI game, there's only one thing that matters, and that is ability to make technology in a manner that would manifest itself. So if there was some sort of species of being on a distant planet that got as far as making stone tools, wouldn't be of much help to us. They would have to have something at least as far as radio telescopes, preferably something even better, like some sort of mega structures, something that would impact not only the planet but the stellar environment that we might be able to spot with a careful survey. So that's the sort of intelligence that matters. But there's another factor that comes into play here, which I think is really important. When we think about what's happening right here on planet Earth, and I insert the caution that we mustn't always anthropomorphize, but if we just take a look at what's happening here, that a lot of our, what we might call intelligent heavy lifting, the intellectual heavy lifting taking place with our species at the moment, is machine intelligence, or computers, if you like, or networks of computers. And in about another 50 years, I think most of the important decision-making, designing, and manufacturing is going to be carried out by post-biological intelligence. You can invent names for this, that you can call these things, you know, supercomputers, robots, whatever you like. We really lack a name, because what will happen, I think, within a very few decades, is that the intelligent systems, artificial intelligence systems we're designing now, will design their own successors, and they'll design their successors, and so on. And this will unleash an exponential growth in intellectual power, but also in technological power. And so come back in another, say, 300 years to planet Earth, and it will be dominated by this non-human intelligence. So it seems to me inevitable that if we ever do detect signs of alien intelligence, we're not going to be dealing with, like, flesh and blood beings. We're going to be dealing with the machine products of long since vanished biological systems. I just insert one note of caution there. When I say biological, there's no particular reason why you can't build a biological machine. That is, that our future robots or design systems might be hybrids of electronics and organic stuff and so on. So they may be, in a sense, biological, but they wouldn't be like the Darwinian evolved originators of this escalating increase in intellectual prowess and technological prowess. So we'd be dealing with something very, very strange. And how do we recognize that? It would have godlike properties.
Well, when you say long since vanished, are you suggesting that we will soon, at some point, be long since vanished and supplanted by our one-time creations?
I think it's probably going to be the case that if you came back and I say 300 years, well, let me play safe, came back in 500 years, there would be no semblance of what you might call a human being left here. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, not necessarily a bad thing. The reason I say that is because if our present generation would like to be remembered for something, it would surely not be for our physical form, our five fingers and toes, that sort of thing. It would be for our cultural and intellectual achievements and our values. And if we were to sort of embed those values and cultural achievements into some system that would convey them into the future, human-like values, if you like, we could imagine that would live on in whatever bizarre design system it is I'm talking about or trying to imagine. And so the legacy of humanity would still be there, but probably not the actual flesh and blood beings with all their defects.
It's funny that you say that, and we're getting off topic, and I don't want to stray too much, but when I think about the things that I think matter, like in terms of the arts, you know, poetry and music and visual art and things like that, I mean, they're all fundamentally based in the body. I mean, they're about sex and death and inhabiting a biological body in such a deep way. And it seems like, I mean, a computer will never know sex or death, right? So can we transmit that?
Yes, I wouldn't like to speculate on whether a computer could know sex. It doesn't have to know death, you're quite right, because they are, in a sense, immortal. You're right. I mean, I think we inevitably something would be lost. And I'm not advocating this. This is a dystopian future. I wouldn't look forward to such a thing. It's just that I feel that on present trends, it's inevitable. Now, I say on present trends, it may be that all of this will come to a shuddering halt, that there are plenty of ways in which human society might make a mess of things and forestall this. I hesitate to use the word takeover because it's not so much that as a self-inflicted, self-initiated vision of progress. But all it would take is some sort of major war, and maybe this whole sort of IT escalation would come to a halt. I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's going to carry on. And it just seems sort of inevitable that human beings are just going to be left behind. Now, it may be that we will still be part of the picture in 500 years, but a very minor part of the picture. And any alien civilization wanting to converse with ours is not going to be bothered with these few human beings who might write great words of literature that mean something only to themselves or extol the values of personal relations or something. They probably wouldn't be interested in that. It probably wouldn't mean anything. And in the same way, if we were to contact some extraterrestrial civilization now, we could, I think, have a very productive discussion about the laws of physics and the history of the universe and maybe great issues of philosophy and mathematics. On all of this, we would have a common language. But if we started talking about sport or politics or anything of that sort, we'd be totally lost, and it would be really boring, I think, to be told whatever sport it is that they might play. And so I think when it comes to exchange of understanding and information between very, very advanced communities, then the sort of human values that we've been talking about are probably just not going to be of any interest. They're of interest to us, but I don't think they'll be of interest to anybody else.
So have we defined life? I mean, does life have to be water and carbon-based? Is there a different set of chemical compounds that could give rise to beings that reproduce and move around and things like that?
You're asking one of the great foundational questions of astrobiology, which is we can go look for life, but what exactly we're looking for, we lack a definition of it. Now, obviously, if we were to go to Mars and find something like a ribosome, we would say that inevitably that is life or the product of life, and probably something very much like terrestrial life, might even be terrestrial life, might have got there in impact ejecta or something. But what we would really like is an objective definition of life based not upon the stuff of which we're made or it's made, but upon its informational properties. And at ASU, we have a big research program. A lot of this is in the Beyond Center. I'm deeply involved in trying to come up with an informational definition of life. That is a software definition, not a hardware definition. So if you say, well, is it going to be carbon-based? That's like saying, does a computer have to be silicon-based? And we all know that the secret of a computer lies really with its software, its information processing capabilities, not with the actual physical hardware of which it's made. You need the hardware, but it doesn't have to be any particular type of hardware. So we're working furiously on trying to come up with a software definition of life. And indeed, I've written a whole new book about that. It's called The Demon in the Machine, and it's coming out very soon in the United States. So what drives me at the moment, trying to understand what is life in terms of its information, organization, and management properties.
You're listening to The Radio Cafe. We're talking to Paul Davies. We'll be back in just a half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. If we someday, going back to this question of the mechanism by which life is created from matter, if we figure that out and we find that the necessary conditions or the sufficient conditions for life exist on countless planets, we're still not anywhere near intelligent life. There might be millions of planets covered in bacteria or some other thing like that. Is evolution a necessary part of the definition of life? Is that part of what life means, is evolution?
You're touching again on a very profound issue, and it's one that's been fudged during the history of SETI. If you look very carefully at the expectations of SETI enthusiasts, the handful of SETI practitioners, there is this 19th century assumption of evolutionary progress, the idea being that the Darwinian evolution has a sort of directionality to it in the direction of greater complexity, leading ultimately to intelligence. It was a view that was very fashionable in the 19th century. People accepted Darwinian evolution, the mechanism of evolution, right from the get-go, most people, but they still saw in it the sort of guiding hand, possibly of God if you wanted, but of nature in some more abstract way, leading this process towards, as it were, better and better. And on Earth, human beings were regarded as the pinnacle of this evolutionary ladder of progress. Well, that all went out of fashion a few decades ago, and people said, well, there is no directionality. It's all just sort of random. It's exploring the space of possibilities. There's nothing exceptional about human beings. It's just obviously we think there is because we are human, and so we're just projecting human values onto the process. This argument is still not completely resolved. There are still many biologists who say, well, yes, there isn't a sort of guiding hand, but there can be directional trends, and intelligence has good survival value, and once you get a bit of it, it's likely to become amplified. And this sort of goes back and forth, and I sit a little bit on the fence on this one. I don't think there's anything inevitable that given a planet with microbes that you're going to get intelligent beings even after a few billion years. And if you look back at the steps that it has taken here on Earth to go from microbes to humans, there are a number of bottleneck transitions which took a very long time. One of these is sex, for example. Another is the appearance of eukaryotic cells, the big cells with nuclei which we're made, and the central nervous system. These were very big steps. If you think about the step to what we might call like true intelligence, technology type intelligence, it could have arisen on Earth any time in the last roughly 300 million years. But true telescope building intelligence only arose very recently, in the last 1-2 million years, depending on where you want to draw the line. So that suggests that the transition from just, say, plants and animals to actual technology-type intelligence is a really rather difficult step. So even if life got going and even if it became complex, it's entirely possible that it would never make that transition to what we would regard as our form of intelligence.
So let's say that, just for the sake of argument, that there were intelligent civilizations who have created technology on planets, let's say in our galaxy or close to our galaxy. And even that, I mean, civilization, that word seems very anthropocentric to me because it references cities and citizens and so on. But anyway, let's say there are these beings. There's a big question of why would they ever want to leave their planet in the first place, even if they had technology, and if they did, how they would get here, given constraints of physics, distance, fuel, not to mention their life support, whatever that is, unless they were technological beings that didn't need to eat or whatever. Are those limits prohibitive to interplanetary travel? Do we know enough to even say?
You're right to draw attention to the vast distances between planetary systems. And a lot of my colleagues who are interested in these things think that humans will never travel to the stars, for example, and that the resources and the time necessary would just mean that these even very advanced civilizations would probably be isolated. And after all, if they can signal to each other with radio or lasers or something, why bother to do the travel? It would require a huge amount of wanderlust to go to the effort, the enormous resources to actually physically go to your neighboring civilization, planetary system, when they can just send you the YouTube video or whatever it would take. Okay. Why do you need to go, as it were, in person? Having said that, although I don't think the transportation of living beings is really very likely, we can send technology, and indeed I'm involved in Yuri Milner's breakthrough Starshot speculation, I call it initiative, to send microchips to Alpha Centauri riding on laser beams. This is possible, would require a lot of effort, just to send microchips. It's not impossible that there is or was alien technology in our solar system. I don't think aliens, but their technology, possibly. The point being that if life is as common as some of my SETI colleagues hope, and if intelligent life is a substantial fraction of planets with life, then it only takes one expansionary community, and by expansionary it doesn't mean the beings themselves, but their technology, it only takes one to populate the galaxy with their stuff. And this is often known as the Fermi paradox. It was spotted back in the 1940s by Enrico Fermi, that if you've got an expansionary community out there somewhere, it's had plenty of time to spread across the galaxy. And I don't rule out that this is a possibility. It just takes one. So whereas most communities might be like ours, probably stuck in one place forever and ever, if you get one out there somewhere in our galaxy, then it's been around a long time. The galaxy is 12, 13 billion years old. There could have been planets with life long before Earth even existed. So plenty of time to spread across the galaxy. So if life is common, we would expect to find the products of intelligent life nearby. And who knows? We may. I'm interested in just searching within the solar system, just in case. I think it's a huge long shot, but great fun to do.
Right, right. I mean, one of the things that I really appreciated about your book was that you write about what we don't know, and that it's possible that things will be discovered and invented that we haven't, you know, our imaginations haven't even thought of yet. Things maybe that will be discovered that we currently think are impossible or highly improbable. Those kinds of things, of course, spark the imaginations of science fiction writers. Things like wormholes or the bending of space-time to make space travel fast or even instantaneous, sort of Star Trek-y kind of stuff. Are these things, are wormholes possible? Could they solve the problem of long-distance space travel if they were real?
Again, you're asking a very pertinent question, because we come right up against how do we assess what the possibilities are. The only way we can do that reliably is to use our best understanding of science. Now, if we imagine fantastic science, then, of course, you can have anything you want. It becomes a rather valueless exercise, supposing you can travel faster than light. Well, that would solve the problem of the time factor to get across the galaxy. And you know, suppose you could dematerialize and just transmit the information and then rematerialize. Well, that would cut out the cost of the journey. And you can imagine all those things. But the problem about imagining science not as we know it is that anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's, and it just does become science fiction. So I think we have to do our best within the understanding of fundamental physics and astronomy that we have, and that's actually pretty good. We have a really good grasp. When we look out into the universe and we see things like black holes and supernovae and all the other paraphernalia of astronomy, we have a really pretty good understanding of it. So my feeling is that we stick with what we've got. And you ask specifically, well, could you travel through a wormhole and get across the galaxy very quickly? I actually wrote a book about that. It's called How to Build a Time Machine, because a wormhole space transit system can be turned into a time travel system. You can go into the past, unleashing all sorts of paradoxes and problems. So most of my physics colleagues think that that can't happen for that reason. It would sort of upset the whole causal order of the universe. And they're probably right, but one little bit of me still retains some belief that it may be possible to create something like a traversable wormhole. But this isn't something that we're going to do in the near future. It's something that would require the attention of a super civilization. It's so technologically challenging from what we understand of the general theory of relativity, immensely challenging, that it's really hard to imagine it except in a civilization that has been around for millions and millions and millions of years. Probably it is impossible, but who knows?
Like, when I think about this stuff, I mean, I love this whole area of inquiry, because it makes you live in the unknown, and or in that borderline between the known and the unknown. I mean, I find myself wondering, okay, let's say there's alien life out there somewhere, and they're building spaceships to come visit us, and we're, you know, asking questions about how they get here and whether the distances are too long. Maybe that's as antiquated as the idea that if you want to send someone a message, you have to put it in an envelope and ship it over land and sea. Now we just send an email and it's there in a second. I mean, who's to say that 100 or 1,000 years from now we won't have the equivalent of something like that?
It's straightforward to take known physics and known technology and extrapolate it. So if you're just limited by resources or by money, you can figure it out. And let me give you an example. We were just talking briefly about time travel. If you have a wormhole, you could go back in time. But going forwards in time actually is pretty straightforward. We can do that at the moment. We've done it by small amounts. You just have to travel very fast. The faster you go, the more you leap into the future. You can do it in measurable amounts now with atomic clocks. You can measure this time warp or time shift. It's only a matter of money and engineering. We could send an astronaut off into space who would come back in 500 years' time, only 1 year older. That's purely a matter of money. We understand the physics perfectly. You need some sort of gigantic type of spacecraft or propulsion system to do that, but there's no problem in principle about doing it. So it's easy enough for us to think, well, you know, in another million years, imagine what would happen. You could rearrange the solar system or build huge structures around the sun to trap all its light. All of these things are just an extrapolation of known principles of engineering and science. When it comes to super science or imaginary science, well, as I said earlier, all bets are off and it becomes a little bit valueless. And then we're just into the realm of not even science fiction. I would call it science fantasy. And some people love to do that, but in the Beyond Center, we inhabit this realm you've been talking about, sort of in the twilight zone between the known and the unknown, where we try to push the boundaries. It's called the Beyond Center for a reason, and that is we like to push a bit beyond what is our known understanding and look at these fundamental questions of science and critically question the assumptions that go into why do we think this theory is correct and why do we assume that. And so our job is to probe these sorts of big questions. Our motto is confronting the big questions. And it's fantastic. I often say to people that what is the Beyond Center? We call it the center for cool stuff. And, and it's true that we love talking about these things, but we do try and keep our feet on the ground and make sure that investigations of all of these wonderful topics is carried out in as rigorous a manner as possible. We don't play fast and loose with the laws of the universe.
Well, I was wondering about SETI. I mean, SETI, the Beyond Center, the people who are investigating these things. So far, I mean, nobody's found alien life. What tools are they using and how are those tools evolving?
The whole SETI program began with the recognition that radio telescopes had the power to transmit messages not just across terrestrial distances, but interstellar distances. And so radio telescopes have been the principal way in which people have, as it were, listened into the cosmos in the hope of picking up some alien transmission. Nothing yet. It was then recognized a few decades later that lasers could do the job just as well. And there's a program of optical SETI, as it's called. It's not quite so developed as radio SETI. And then there's a third strand, which is really not looking for messages or signals, but just looking for signatures of alien technology. And of course, that's where it's a little difficult to know quite what to look for. But there are a few things that have been suggested. For example, a very advanced civilization might modify its not just its planetary environment, but its stellar environment. There could be alien megastructures. There's something called the Dyson Sphere, named after Freeman Dyson, a sphere that would encompass a star and trap all of its energy to drive whatever sort of technology is going on, and that would show up in a conspicuous way in an astronomical search. Of course, nobody's seen such a thing. There have been a few false alarms. And the other thing we could do is to look for less grandiose signs of technology, but closer to home, within our solar system. And I had a student a few years ago who was interested in whether we could detect alien artifacts on the moon, and we wrote a little paper about that. And that's an idea that rumbles on. And just very recently, James Benford, he's an engineer and a physicist in California, has discovered that there's a class of objects, they're little asteroids, that are trapped by the Earth and follow the Earth around as it orbits the Sun. So they're not very big, I think, you know, maybe up to 100 meters across, but they would be ideal places for some extraterrestrial technology to lurk. And so he calls these things lurkers. I think there are a couple of dozen of them. And he's coming to give a lecture at ASU in September on looking for lurkers. And it's entitled, Is ET Hiding in Our Cosmic Backyard? And again, these ideas are wonderful to think about. Almost certainly this isn't the case, but we should consider every avenue when we're looking for signs of extraterrestrial intelligence, because we have no idea how a very advanced civilization might manifest itself.
When you say alien artifacts on the moon, what are you talking about?
Well, imagine if, say, 100 million years ago, some civilization 200 light years away dispatched a lot of space probes to planetary systems where they thought there might be life or something of interest to look at. And these space probes would be designed to last a very long period of time. We can't do that at the moment, but we can imagine a machine that might last for half a billion years or something, be self-repairing, something of that sort. And this would be, in our case, it might have been sent to the solar system. And where would it be in the solar system? What's a good place to put it? Well, one possibility is the so-called Lagrange points. These are regions of empty space, but the gravitational circumstances are such that anything left there doesn't need any sort of in-course correction. It just would maintain its station relative to Earth forever. And so that's one place you might choose to put something. The surface of the Earth is a very bad place. As we know, nothing survives very long here. You only need to go to Central America and see the vanished cities of only a few hundred years ago. They've just been sort of totally swallowed up. So, but the moon is pretty inert, and although there's meteorites will churn it up a bit, something could sit on the surface of the moon for 100 million years and still be discernible today. And so it just seems like a sensible place to look, because we're mapping the moon anyway. And so this is all out there for free. Just have to take a look. So these are the sorts of things that interest me. They interest me not because I think it's likely we're going to find anything, but they're quick and easy and cheap. And it's a great way of getting young people enthused about the about science in general, but the possibility of alien intelligence in particular.
I have to say, and again, the question of intelligence is one that is so interesting to me, because not all cultures define intelligence in terms of technological innovation. I mean, some people define it in much more human terms and in terms of wisdom and in terms of our real kind of fundamental loving humanity. I don't know what words to use, but I can imagine, and I think I'm emotionally drawn to a definition of intelligence which is perhaps less technological and more involved in principles of wisdom, like, for example, Buddhism.
Of course, what you're saying is absolutely correct. I mentioned earlier, we have these different definitions of intelligence, and the people we like are probably not those who are real whiz with mathematics and technology, but people with empathy and leading a good life and having a good character and so on. We value these things, of course we do. It's just that if there is some stay-at-home civilization of saintly beings out there, chances are we're not going to know about them, because they're not going to have technological signatures. And so the right. name of the game in SETI is really looking for technological civilizations, not necessarily good civilizations. And it's interesting that your question actually mirrors the history of religion, because you think, you know, all these gods that have been invented in human history, what were they good for? Some of them did have technological prowess. So the Judeo-Christian god, you know, could sort of move mountains and things like that. But I think mostly when people think of religion and gods, they're thinking in terms of wisdom and mercy and understanding and so on. And you see an amalgam of those two versions of God in the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. So what we're seeing in SETI, and your question betrays it, I think, very well, we're seeing a reprise of all of the existential queries that people have asked throughout history, which they transferred to what we would call religion, but we're just transplanting them into this sort of technological search for super beings or super intelligences out there somewhere in the universe that could somehow put things right, solve the problems of the human condition. So it's a big religious component behind this whole SETI stuff.
Well, I find myself wondering, and people, this is not originating with me, but people saying, well, I believe in God or in a creator, because how did that first cell get created? Evolution takes it from there. I have no problem with evolution, but that origin of life, you know, we haven't explained it. And I mean, that's a place where religious people do put their faith.
Yes, in a misplaced manner, in my view, because this is the so-called God of the gaps. It says that science might be very good at explaining this and that, but if science can't explain something, well, that's a place for God to pop up. Very poor sort of God who sits back doing very little, but from time to time leaps up and prods a few molecules around. So we absolutely don't want to have to appeal to a miracle to turn non-life into life. The fact that we don't know how it happened, don't know how to quantify it, doesn't mean it was magic. I firmly believe there was a series of physical processes that brought it about, just we don't understand what they are, and we don't understand the laws and principles that govern that transition. But to invoke God, it's a very poor sort of God, I think, that would have that type of manifestation.
So when all is said and done, what do you think and what do you hope about the possibility or probability of alien life in the rest of the world?
I started this discussion by saying that I'm an interested skeptic. I've become more skeptical over the years, but in some sense more interested. And so for me, it would be a wonderful culmination of my career if we could just find just a single microbe that had arisen from scratch independently of life on Earth. Just that step. Of course, to find evidence of an alien civilization or alien wisdom or something like that would be totally stupendous. And of course, that would be a really wonderful thing to hope for. But I'm realistic enough to know that this is actually very unlikely, but I still retain the hope that sometime within my lifetime, either right here on Earth or in one of the nearby planets, we will actually discover life, but not as we know it. And that would be a wonderful first step to resolving all of the questions that we've been discussing.
Thank you so much for your time, Paul.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Davies is author of the book The Eerie Silence. He's a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and astrobiologist. He's Regents Professor and Director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science and co-director of the Cosmology Initiative, all at Arizona State University. Radio Cafe would like to thank the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, and the Santa Fe Institute for sponsoring this program. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the LANL Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.